Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is September 23rd, 2004. Today's speaker is Cliff Hall. The lesson for today is Health and Wellness for the Over 50, Ethical Dilemmas in Contemporary Medicine. Let's listen in.
There were a couple of loose ends out of the previous conversation that we've had. And one was, what's the role, if any, of caffeine or chocolate in one's life? And caffeine seems to be a plus minus. If you have some caffeine, it's not harmful in any way. If you drink too much, and too much is probably something like 6 to 8 cups of coffee per day, if you keep it under that, it probably is neither good nor bad. If it helps you get through the Seattle weather, then it's good. Too much caffeine can raise blood pressure, it can cause stomach irritation, influence secretion of acid in the stomach, and can, if you're taking an aspirin a day, or if you're taking non-steroidals or something like that, Motrin, Advil, those kinds of medicines, then you won't have to get peptic ulcer disease. So it's probably best to avoid it in high concentration. The story on chocolate is interesting. We seem to have receptors in the brain for chocolate, and they are somewhat antidepressants. They are stimulants. Both caffeine and chocolate can keep you awake at night. If you have trouble with acid reflux, try to avoid chocolate in the evening. But the way to a woman's heart is chocolate. I found that out over the years. And chocolate is fine. It is a fat, has lots of calories. And I don't know if anybody knows, if you ate most of your calories with chocolate, how healthy you'd be or not. You might be very happy.
What about chocolate and cholesterol?
Chocolate will raise cholesterol a little bit, but you'd have to eat a lot of chocolate to really have it has to make up a significant amount of your calories. Just a small, have a few pieces of chocolate every day is not going to have a major impact on your cholesterol. Other factors affect cholesterol far more than what we eat, and I think everybody they've ever been told they had high cholesterol and went on a diet, they realize that, because you eliminate all your fat, you're eating just lettuce, and your cholesterol really doesn't drop very much. You just kind of referred to that yesterday. It's very depressing. You diet like crazy, and you get your cholesterol, and it's down 10 points, you know, from 250 to 240 or something. You say, gee, was it worth it? And then they give you a little pill like Lipitor or something like that, and your cholesterol drops 50, 60, 80 points just like that, and you say, wow.
What does the Lipitor do to your system?
I'm sorry, what does it do?
What does the Lipitor do? I'm not the long-term effect of it. Do we know that?
The statins have only been around.
Yes, I was really...
So in what way? In the immediate term, has a tremendous effect. Good, bad?
Good, absolutely good.
To take Lipitor to reach...
Well, I'm not using... The statins is a whole group of drugs. Lipitor is the...
To take something to reduce cholesterol?
If your cholesterol is high, and if you're at high risk of coronary disease, or if you already have established coronary disease. So almost everyone who has coronary disease and has heart disease, known heart disease, probably should be on a statin drug. They are very effective. They have a and the studies involve thousands and thousands. Yes, I'm sorry?
Retired. When I retired, my cholesterol went.
Really?
Yeah.
Exercise. Stress. And my oatmeal every day.
Oatmeal. That's so. Yeah, there are a number of things.
Niacin, though, it has a more effect on the liver, right?
Yes.
It does. It can. It's the least expensive of the cholesterol lowering medications that are out there. I was asked also, what about medical use for marijuana? That's sort of a topic of interest. Just so to make it clear here, marijuana smoking is not permitted here at Holden Village, so keep the pot in your suitcase. It's been used for a hundred, but she did use it. There are receptors in the brain for cannabinoids, which are the active ingredient in marijuana. And we probably produce chemicals ourselves which are very, very similar to the chemicals you find in marijuana. In the same way, we produce chemicals that are very similar to opium and morphine, the endogenous opioids that we produce. So when a medicine works on us, it's frequently because there are receptors for, it's been used for a number of things medically, and there's been a number of studies. It turns out that marijuana is just not that great a drug for very many things. It's been used for nausea. We have medicines that are much more potent and much more effective in studies. It's been used in Alzheimer's disease, but felt to decrease the deposition of the plaque that forms in the brain. It's unclear whether it really has any impact on the natural history of Alzheimer's disease. It does have an effect on glaucoma, but we've got really good eye drops that you could use. It has some relief of pain. And then there's the downside. Somebody really pushing for something for medical, you always have to wonder, is that really why they're doing it? There are always hidden motives in almost everything that gets done. Yeah.
Well, Jan's mother and my grandfather both used it for asthmatic conditions. Dilated or something, the respiratory.
It's been touted for that. The scientific evidence that it helps is pretty minimal. Yeah. And in actual fact, if you smoke several joints a day, there appears to be an increased risk of lung cancer, and there may very well be an increased risk of emphysema, the same kind of chronic obstructive respiratory problems that one can get from smoking cigarettes. So there clearly is a downside to it as well. But it may have, I'm not saying it didn't help them, it didn't provide some relief, and they may have gotten some other ancillary benefits from it as well. any questions about discussions yesterday on faith and spirituality? And we talked about intercessory prayer, we talked about the healthy habits of people who tend to be religious or follow religious practices. That tends to be reflected in both mortality rates and in health status. One thing we haven't discussed in this series of discussions, and we're not going to, is all the kinds of technology that's truly phenomenal. It is just absolutely exciting what has gone on in my professional career. When I think of what we had, I entered medical school in 1964. So in those 40 years, we have gone from just an unbelievably, looking at it now, it's amazing how anybody was alive, how we kept anybody alive back in 1964, knowing what we know now, and having the facilities and technology that we have now. And it's obviously, all science has been extraordinarily successful. So the scientific model for medicine has just proved very, very good. It has brought with it a whole bunch of other problems, and they've been the ethical problems, and has led some observers to say that we've become scientific giants but ethical midgets, and our ethics just hasn't kept up. We've tried, but as every time you read about another new advance, it raises other ethical problems. Should we even be doing this kind of thing, and how do we distribute if we have a very expensive, highly technological treatment or a diagnostic procedure, and it's too expensive to apply to everyone? How to follow baseball a little bit? We know that Mickey Mantle, who was a chronic alcoholic, had developed liver cancer. He somehow got to the top of the list to get a liver transplant, knowing that there are a shortage of liver organs. How did that happen? And should it have happened? So there's a lot of serious ethical problems, and today we're going to kind of discuss ethics and some basic principles of ethics, and I hope when we leave here today, we'll have sort of a background, a way of looking at some of these ethical problems, and see how they relate to medicine. If you ask somebody, what is ethics? Ethics is really a system of thinking about moral values, of right behavior, of finding out what's the right thing to do, of doing what's good, of knowing what is good, of living what's good. Love, right from the outset, we should make a distinction, and I know everybody here is part of that way, that if a law now, it used to be that we would say that torture didn't exist officially or legally in the United States, and I think it presently does, that's not ethical. just spoke to a physician who came back from Afghanistan. I probably shouldn't get into any political discussion, but he came back and they were talking about when they took care of some of the Taliban fighters who had been wounded, and they turned them back over. I mean, they patched them up for this, but had no obviously had no control over that. His job was to patch people up, and then if they were in the custody of the military police, then whatever happened to them was beyond his control. But it was something that he did not feel particularly good about, obviously. So we make that distinction between what's legal and what's ethical. I am not an ethicist. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a cleric. I'm a physician who's practiced for and been around out. And it's such as an individual's desire for privacy and society's right to know. So you just think about that right off the bat. To somebody that has an infectious or contagious disease doesn't want everyone to know about it. However, that person is walking around the community, potentially spreading the disease, doesn't society have a right to know? Now, those are two important things, aren't they? How do you decide? Society may have a legitimate right to know. So that's just one issue. What if you know someone is potentially dangerous and is threatening to kill somebody, and you know that? I mean, I know that priests have this problem and confess, violate the trust in terms of confidentiality. So there are these kinds of ethical issues. Over the years, ethics, medical ethics, has dealt a lot with prescriptions of thou shalt nots. And I don't really want to get into that because that's pretty clear. Now, a physician or a nurse or a medical technician shalt not steal from his patient. When the patient's in anesthesia and unconscious, you don't go into the room and rifle through the purse and take the money. You just let the insurance company do it. Sorry, I'm sorry, I shouldn't do that. Gay's not here, so I guess I can't do it now.
Well, I'll take this long stick.
You know, thou shalt not abuse the patient sexually or physically, maintain confidentiality. You shouldn't be involved in fee splitting or double billing, and there's all kinds of those thou shalt nots, and that's it deals with the temptations, and there's a series of ethical standards. What we're really going to talk about mainly today are the ethical dilemmas, just like I mentioned a couple little cases there. We'll try to get into that. It's not clear what's right and wrong, but you have to have some kind of framework in which you can behave and act, because whether we like it or not, these are issues that we have to deal with. And physicians and nurses and healthcare professionals deal with a specific set of ethical problems almost on a daily basis. Historically, it goes back to the Hippocratic Oath, which we've mentioned a couple sessions ago, 500 BC. Hippocrates had three do's and five don'ts. His do's, and it starts out, the Hippocratic Oath that every physician takes, starts out, and I'll quote it, I will, can't read my writing here, I will prescribe, so the do's in the Hippocratic Oath are to prescribe. In fact, the word doctor means teacher. Physician means to give a purging. So that's where the derivation terms give a physic. The do-nots were to do no harm, to not to murder one's patients, not to perform abortion, not to perform surgery, and not to seduce one patient. Isn't it interesting that there are a whole bunch of medical things, and seduction sort of gets thrown into there as a do-not in the Hippocratic Oath? But the Hippocratic Oath says, I will not do surgery. Because that was, at the time, that you were killing far more patients than you were helping. That obviously is anachronistic and doesn't apply today, and that's been eliminated. We've passed out that other sort of updated form of a creed of ethics. But it's also in the Hippocratic Oath is not to perform abortion. So that's even back at that point, there was an issue. Underlying all of, probably no better place that we can see the service act, right here at Holden Village, I think it really is that. The way I look at ethics and it's not just me, it's, and I don't claim this because there's a couple long words up here that clearly I didn't come up with. There are four, I don't know, can you read that? There are four basic principles of ethics, and virtually every ethical problem that we deal with, these conundrums, these dilemmas, these ethical dilemmas, the things that don't seem to be right or wrong, one can kind of break down, at least in medical ethics, I don't think you can break down all ethical problems in this, but in the medical ethics, into these four competing principles that we can agree on, and most medical ethicists and physicians have agreed on, that these are key issues. And they all fall under service. We have to remember that service to the patient community remain the basis of the profession. Autonomy is number one. That's respect for individuals. And that involves concern about confidentiality and disclosure. One has to be honest with individuals and faithful to them. So autonomy is a very important thing. Individuals should be allowed to, if you have that respect, they can make their own decisions. We should respect their own individuality, and we should be absolutely honest with them. Beneficence, which is a big word, which I think is spelled right up there, that means to do good, just doing good. And that involves kindness, it's a positive duty to one's patient's charity. Non-maleficence is the old don't harm somebody. And that's different from beneficence, okay? Because harming is a more active kind of thing. Beneficence is doing something for this for someone's good. And of course, in medicine, sometimes we have to harm someone in order to help them. And justice, which is the last one, and in some ways one of the more difficult ones to come to grips with, involves equity. When do they get it? How is it delivered? It obviously is much. How is this system just? How does our current system meet any possible criteria of justice whatsoever when we have comprehensive health care for, as we mentioned before, people in the military or criminals when they're in jail or congressmen or people over 65, and then we have 46 million people with no health insurance whatsoever, including many children. What is the sense of justice there? It's been probably the principle that when we look at justice espoused by John Stuart Mill in the 1800s, and that was the greatest good for the greatest number. So we get down to the greatest good, and that's how we ought to be making decisions. And I think most people accept that. In the Star Trek, for those of you who are Trekkies and watched the Star Trek series in the 70s and 80s, Mr. Spock would say this frequently. He would say, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. That's something that he said frequently. I can remember, you know, see him standing there talking to Kirk, and when they're trying to make a decision out there about some interplanetary battle they're about to fight, or another world they're about to explore, and how do they make it, and how. So one can look at it and say, well, let's be a very egalitarian society, and that everybody gets the same, and that's ethically pretty sound. Or you can go to what's been called hyper-egalitarianism. And that's a technology that's not available to everybody, shouldn't be available to anybody. So if we can't provide heart transplants for everybody, we shouldn't do heart transplants for anybody. Is that a just or fair system? We could probably discuss that for a while. That probably will never be the situation, although one can could argue that that's really the most just or fair way. And probably what most societies ultimately come down to is we decide lottery system. we need to have 100 people need heart transplants. We only have 20 hearts that we can transplant, 20 donors that would be done on a lottery system. It's been based to a large extent, as it's grown up in this country, on the service area. So that if there's a heart transplant center in Seattle and there's one in Portland, it's who's in one area, and they compete for hearts. And they do. So if you're somewhere halfway in between both teams, the Cortland team and the Seattle team are kind of fighting over the community hospital. They want that hospital to be in their area so that if someone has brain damage from a motor vehicle accident, is brain dead, then the harvest the organs will go to that particular medical center to take care of their particular patients. And so that's been addressed through a national system now. And then it cuts into issues like the likelihood of success. If you have, so age becomes high, it's unlikely, and they're going to tend to want to get the heart transplant to somebody who has had a lot of complications.
But they can use your eyes.
They can use your eyes, and it keeps you, and it solves the problem of whether your family has to sit there and scratch their heads. You know, did Roy really want to be an organ donor? Things change from year to year, and what they will consider now, today, eyes, your skin can be used as well, and they're now starting to take bone from some individuals for transplant purposes. So there are a number of things. So yeah, I think it's still a good idea to check off donor status on your driver's license renewal, wherever it is in your state.
But that someone told me that even though you have that on your license, it's still not, in other words, your family or some can say no.
That's right. Family can always, I mean, the next of kin, if you're married, it's going to be your wife. Spouse comes first, and then it's a parent, and then it comes to children, brothers and sisters. There's a hierarchy of who can make decisions for you.
But if you're at some place far away from your family and no one knows how to contact them, how long is the organ viable?
Well, the organs we're most interested in, liver, heart, kidneys. Those are the ones, because those have been the most successful transplant. Individuals, although sometimes they can be taken from someone who is who has circulatory demise, what we almost always but it gets hard, you know. I mean, some of those rocks are really easy to tell. Others kind of look alike, you know. And sometimes people look, you can't tell if they're. I look around here, and I don't know how many people are. I'm just saying that because I'm probably putting you all to sleep this morning. So, but anyway, it's important. Important point you make. Organ transplants. The three organs we really want: kidney, heart, and liver. If you have a brain dead individual, one can keep the body part alive for hours and sometimes for a day or two, even without any brain function, just with on support mechanisms, artificial ventilators, medications to maintain blood pressure. So the body is still there. The patient is dead.
Yeah.
And the way this works in the hospital is that when the patient is declared brain dead, the chart is closed on that patient and a new chart is opened up. And now physicians are still taking care of this body. They're giving it medication. It's kind of weird when you think about it.
Really?
But we're giving it medications, we're giving it drugs, we're giving it life support, but we're really supporting the organism. We have a preparation, a heart-lung preparation. The brain just isn't part of it. That person is no longer alive. That person does not exist anymore according to any official records. The death certificate's been signed, completed, but we still have this body, and it still has a living, beating heart. The heart's beating away, has a blood pressure, has a pulse, has a functioning liver and kidneys. Then the transplant team will come in and open that body, remove those organs, and take them off to the medical school or the University Medical Center, wherever they're going to be, and the donors have been lined up, and they go into another operating room with a little cooler with the heart. Hospital has right spec. The goal of the ethics committee is not to take the decision away from the family, but to be able to give advice and counsel, and to help direct. And ethics committee become useful when there are conflicts between family members or between the family and what the medical staff thinks is appropriate. The family wants something done or doesn't. Absolutely. And when we get into those kinds of issues that are very heavy, very difficult, it is so helpful to have, if someone is part of a religious community, to have to have the priest or rabbi or the hospital chaplain or someone that has the background in the spiritual realm. And certainly, we've certainly had it in our hospital too with Native American healers and religious leaders to be able to relate to families, feel that this is a chance to, that this untimely tragedy, well, that's a question. I mean, that, we get right into the autonomy issue, isn't it? It's a desire for privacy, it generally is a power act.
That my loss by knowing personally the person who has helped.
But that person may not want to know. I mean,
they may not know.
It's the same thing about children that are given up for adoption, you know, years and years ago, and then you know, sometimes, you know, the biological mother or father don't really want that child to come back into their lives. So, I mean, that's a different part. And so, you get it, and yet there's the desire to want to know. So, one has to respect the autonomy there, and then you have that competing. What my desire to know versus your desire to keep it private, which should take preference, and that's being fought in the courts right now because it comes down to a legal issue because we can't agree on the ethical framework.
It comes down to insurance.
Any other comments about just the way we look at things and these four basic principles? I'm going to give you a case report. It's a true case. Show you how you can look at some of these principles, and then that may be able to help guide making a decision, and yet still how difficult decisions can be. She was a 90-year-old. My job, I was her personal physician. I also took care of permanent pacemakers at our hospital and replaced them and replaced the power pack and things of that sort. So I talked to them. We can get information from them, and they can tell us. We can. Use a little device and by a little radio signal, we can talk to the pacemaker and it can tell us how good the battery is and when the battery's going to run out. Mm-hmm. And then we can adjust it, make it go faster or slower, do all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Well, if you have a permanent pacemaker, you need to be checked periodically so that the technician or the physician can interrogate it, get information from about the pacemaker, and it says, you know, you're approaching the bat, and you want to know this if you have a pacemaker. You don't want to not wake up some morning and say, oh, the flashlight battery's dead, you know. You would like to know a month or two or 3 months ahead of time that the battery pulses you need to keep your heart going, et cetera, et cetera. So she would be coming in every couple months, and she had... all her friends had died. Her daughter was devoted to her daughter, always brought her. Her daughter was just kind of exasperated with this lady because this lady just said, I'm ready to die, I want to die, I don't have any friends. I suppose you've all had friends like this. And that's, and it wasn't that she was really depressed. She still took part. She lived in an assisted living place. She still took part in activities. She was really bright. She still played some bridge. But as far as she was concerned, she say this, but here's a daughter devoted to her, bringing her to every visit. And she, I have no reason for living. I don't live, nobody I care of. You know, she's saying this right in front of her daughter. You know, it was kind of awful. But they do that. My mother did that to me all the time. So, but it's very, very common. So think about it when your kids bring you, another 10, 15 years, when we're all being brought into the doctor's office and kids are bringing us there, how important it is to thank them and appreciate that they're really there. But anyway, that's just a whole other story. I'm ready to die. And then she said to me, she looked right in the eye, and she said, I don't want you to replace this pacemaker when it goes dead. Now, no one has ever said that to me. I had about 100 patients that I was following that had pacemakers, and when the indicator came, it was just automatic. It was a minor procedure. You just went in, you made a little incision, took out the old pacemaker. You got a whole new pacemaker. You don't change the battery. You just get a whole brand new pacemaker. Hook it up to the wires, test it, make sure the wires are working fine. If there's a problem with the wires, you just slip another wire into the heart. It's not a mine right now. I would tell you not to put the pacemaker in the first place. 10 years ago, I wanted the pacemaker, but no, I don't want the pacemaker. I just want to die. Well, if that's kind of heavy stuff because now all colleagues, I mean, if I go around saying that I'm not going to replace this pacemaker, this is going to be investigated. I can assure you that this is some kind of Paul's going off the deep end over here. You know? he needs a psychiatric evaluation, and because that's just not the way things are done. So it's you have this kind of dilemma. So I talked to her. I said, "Well, you know, you're getting along. You're doing these things. You still have this relationship with your daughter. You have friends. You're doing. No, I don't want anything to do with it. I just want to just die." And then I kept thinking, what if she had said, take it out? Not just let it go dead. Take that damn thing out. You know, take a little incision and take it out. Well, boy, that's even going up to another level, isn't it? So I, you know, I went home, I thought about this, you know. I said, you know, I told her to think about it, and I thought about it, and wondered about it. Just thinking, you know, maybe the next time I see her, she's going to have changed her mind, you know. She didn't. It hadn't reached, the indicator hadn't come up yet. She came back a couple more visits, still said, now when it goes dead, and I said, well, you know, if that's the case, then I don't want to, we're just not going to test it anymore, because I don't want to know when it's going to go dead, we're not going to replace it. But I said, you really need to... You know, I talked to her and I said, you know, what I really have to find out is, are you going to die if it stops? Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people have pacemakers, and they have pacemakers for different reasons. Some people have pacemakers because they have had a couple episodes where they blacked out. Some people have pacemakers because the heart goes slow all the time. It's just too slow. And some people have pacemakers because they have no heartbeat without a pacemaker. And they are clearly what we call pacemaker dependent. Mm-hmm. That they will die if the pacemaker stops. So I said... So I went back in direct talk to these pacemakers. So I got it back in the office, and you can slow that pacemaker down if you want to. You just sort of crank it down. You don't turn the dial. You just punch in some numbers. So the pacemaker was set at 75, and she'd been getting along very well at 75. So we just turned it down to 60, and then her heart was going 60. I turned it down to 50. The heart was going 50. I turned it down to 40, and then she started having a couple beats of her own. I turned it down to 30, and she had all her own beats, but they were running between 30 and 45. Well, you can live with a heart rate of 30 and 45. You don't feel very good. Mm-hmm. You're liable to develop congestive heart failure. You're probably going to be dizzy. Every time you stand up, you're going to fall down. And so now I have a different situation. It isn't that when this pacemaker failed, she wasn't just going to gone dead. Yeah. Nice, quick, sudden death, the way any of us would like to do it at 90. I mean, that's not a bad way to go. She was going to, if we let that pacemaker go, she was going to have a heart rate of 30, 35, and she was going to feel miserable. Mm-hmm. She was going to be weak, lightheaded, dizzy. She was going to fall. She'd probably break a hip. Mm-hmm. She would end up getting her hip fixed. Yeah. She would have surgery. I mean, I could just picture all kinds of bad things happening to poor lady. And when I explained all this to her, she was disappointed. I said, you know, I got good news for you. You're not going to die. And then that was not what she wanted to hear. And so we discussed it, and she, a few months later, and she said, well, I'll think about it. You know, she was always thinking about things. I'll think about this. And a few months later, the end of life indicator came, and she said, you know, I don't want to be dizzy and lightheaded, and I let's go get the pacemaker replaced. It was replaced, and she lived for another 3 or 4 years. Daughter still kept bringing her in, and she kept staying. There was no reason to. but I think you can see the kind of ethical issues. But overriding it all is the importance of technical quality and of service, of trying to really get the right information so that your decisions are really based on as much as possible on that. But that kind of begs the question, and I'm going to pose it out to you all now. What if we had cranked it down and she had no heart rate at 30, you know, 30, I cranked it down to 20 and it was just nothing. And I said, okay, whoa. Those are the ones that give doctors almost heart attacks when we're in the operating room putting these pacemakers in because, you know, we got a temporary wire in and we know that the patient's life is absolutely dependent on getting electrical activity to the heart. If we don't do that, the patient's going to die. You know? So those are the kinds of things when you're removing one wire, putting in another wire, making these connections, because when you disconnect it from the temporary pacemaker, you hook it to the permanent pacemaker, you're screwing those things as tight, as fast as you can, there's no heartbeat at all, the patient has, until that connection is solid, you know, so you're kind of, it's tense.
Life or death.
It is potentially life or death. Now, you know, but it's, and I don't want to make it too dramatic, But it's probably the most dramatic thing that I ever got. I mean, the cardiac surgeons do really dramatic stuff. I mean, but as an internist, you don't do too many super dramatic things, but that's one of the more dramatic things. But what if she, we found out about over, well, battery dead, and she would be dead. Should, what would you have done? And she says, don't replace it. How many here, and this is, but did you have, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. Is there, I'm seeing the carryover to signing a release saying that you don't want any CPR. Is that not in the same category? I don't want to do CPR. I don't want to be revived from my heart.
Well, is it?
Is it?
I'm asking you.
Well, I don't know. I'm asking you.
Well, I don't
to
either.
Me, it would seem the same.
It's different. I mean, it has the same implication that that is going to the result is going to be death. And it comes into, where does it fit here? It fits into autonomy, that the individual has the right mm-hmm. to refuse treatment okay. or to select treatment or to make his own, his or her medical decision.
Yeah.
And so if somebody says, don't resuscitate me, if you find me, if I drop dead here, don't start CPR, don't hook me up to the machine, don't try to get my heart going again. Mm-hmm. They have a right to do that. Mm-hmm. If somebody says, if the reason they dropped dead was because they don't have any heart activity, that means don't put in a pacemaker. But right. once the pacemaker in, is it different to not keep that pacemaker going or, and I'm going to ask you that, you can see what the next question is going to be, which is, you know, should we take it out if somebody, but let's just deal with the replacement of the battery.
I'll hold it.
Okay. Yeah.
We have that problem with my dad. He's 98 and a half years old. At age 90, he had a pacemaker put in. And now he mentally is fuzzy and still knows my brother who goes to an often in a nursing home. But we've discussed this, what happened.
As it stands now, if the physician says to your brother who visits your dad, or more, he lives closer, says, we just tested the pacemaker, it needs to be replaced because the battery's gonna fail in the next 2 months. We know that, we can predict that with certainty. What's your family gonna do? Or have you decided?
Well, that's the problem, but as it stands now, the do not resuscitate is in effect.
Well, that's
it does drop
well, but you're going to have to make a decision because we can predict when that. Usually, you can't predict when somebody's going to drop dead.
I don't know if he's ever had it tested in 8.5 years.
Oh. Okay, he should have, and he probably has, or maybe the decision already has been made, and you just don't know it. That they've already decided that they're not going to replace it if the time comes.
I think so. I'm not sure.
Who's they?
It would be his father, if his father is capable of making the decision. If it's not, it's whoever your father has determined to be his proxy for health care, which might be your brother.
Yeah,
is your brother in advanced directives? Is it your brother or you that's listed?
It's my brother.
It's your brother.
Yeah.
So his brother, if your dad is fuzzy to the point that he cannot make his own medical decisions right now, mm-hmm. and that's a decision that mm-hmm. that could be a legal decision or it could just be a family decision that he's turned it over. When you sign advance directive, it says if I'm incapable, so that means, you know, if you're brain injured, but there comes a time in your life when you're still awake and alert and you might think you're capable. No one else in the family thinks you're capable. See, that's where we start getting into, that's when we get into legal issues. Before I ask you to vote, a couple more comments.
About the lady with the pacemaker. It seems to me that you also found out, Annette, that if it went out, if I were in that spot, I would encourage her to let it be the way it is. Because
right, I think the way you said that is really right on. It's a quality of life. You don't want less quality of life, and when you have, if you have a chance, when you're out in that age group. And you have a chance to have quality of death, and that's not so bad, is it?
That is good.
That's really not
that
bad at all.
Good.
One more comment before I'm going to...
She's already been living on borrowed time.
That's one way to look at it.
She's been living past what she normally would have died because we have a mechanical way of keeping her alive.
Well, you're probably right, because if she had been at a slow heart rate at 30 for 8 years, she probably would have died. She would have developed congestive heart failure, other complications, and would have died. You're right. She is, I don't know if that's borrowed time, but that's using the technology that's available, so. Okay, how many people here, Bob, get into that tomorrow, a little more about healthcare directives, about what they mean in different states and things of that sort. How many people here would say, if it were up to you to make this decision, the lady who said, don't replace, doctor, you're all physicians, you're all, and the other thing I want you to remember is that if you don't replace it, you charge $35 for an office visit. If you do replace it, you're going to get paid about $800. Throw that into the mix. I want to tell you that because that is a factor of life. That's the way your physician is going to be looking at this too. Now, I'd like to think that that played no role, but we're dealing with thousands of physicians and thousands of pacemakers and everything else out there.
And so pacemakers are expensive. So
pacemakers are expensive too, so society picks up a cost. I mean, actually, it doesn't cost her anything because Medicare is going to pay 100% of this. And a pacemaker is going to cost anywhere from, for the whole procedure to replace that, anywhere from $2,000 to $5,000, maybe six, wow, altogether. So it's not
that way.
Okay, all those who think that she ought to have the pacemaker replaced when the battery fails, will you raise your hand? All those who think that that we would not replace the pacemaker when the battery fails. So it's not proper. One has to make sure that she is competent, that she's fully aware of all the implications of this, that she will die, that she most likely will die suddenly. It is possible something else could happen, that the battery fails, not clunk, but kind of suddenly shifts into some kind of bizarre electrical thing where it's given her a rate of 30 for a while, or just some of the beats get transmitted, and so that she has a whole bunch of crazy symptoms. Because it doesn't always turn out exactly the way you think it's going to turn out.
I see this as a direct life support is taken on.
So is this another form of life support? I think it is. What's different is that this is totally included into the, you know, it's not quite so easy to, well, okay, I'm getting ahead of myself, you know, as far as removing it. As far as not replacing it, I think you make a valid point.
Well, does the health care directive have any effect on this decision?
Not in this case, because her healthcare directive doesn't play a role here, because she is able to talk to me and I'm able to talk to her. Mm-hmm. Healthcare directive is only useful if you can't talk to the patient. And they, you know, that they can't, if you can talk to them, you don't care what they wrote on the healthcare directive 6 years ago. You care what do you want to do right now? I mean, you can explain everything to them. Healthcare directive is sort of an abstract.
But you replaced her pacemaker, right?
We did.
Because she chose.
Understand. I mean, she had a quality of life.
And we determined that she was not going to die when the battery went dead.
Right. And so
So we replaced it.
I can't see voting and saying that you wouldn't replace it.
Not in that situation. I'm talking about the situation if it's no longer Anna Jensen, it's Mary Jones.
Oh.
Mary Jones is pacemaker dependent.
Oh, okay.
She has no heart rate when we remove her pacemaker, or when her pacemaker fails. And she's also 90 years old, and she's ready to die. It's just a different person in a different setting. And I take it the overwhelming majority of people would say that's okay.
Yeah.
Let's just take it the next step. We had just put that pacemaker in 2 years ago, so now we know that pacemaker is good for another 3 or 4 or 5 years. It's not going to just, battery's just not going to go dead on it. Now she says to you, Dr. Bob, Dr. Marion, I don't want to live anymore. And I know that this pacemaker is keeping me alive. Remove it. Take me into the operating room, do a little incision, take it out. Mm-hmm. Or don't even take me to the operating room. It doesn't have to be done sterilely, because she's going to be dead instantaneously. Who cares if it gets infected, right? No. Just do it in your office. Yeah. Just make a little cut, grab the damn thing, pull it out.
He doesn't really practice medicine.
Right. That is suicide.
That's suicide.
So, okay, so she says, remove it. And remember, while you're removing this thing, she's going to die right in front of you.
That's suicide.
That's physician assisted suicide.
That's physician assisted suicide. It may be. But it's removing something she doesn't want. Yeah.
If she can comprehend enough to say, remove the pacemaker, she can also be alive. I mean, if she's got enough sense in her head to say, remove it, she can also lead a quality life.
What if she has, what if she has double amputee because of the diabetes. She has horrible, what's left of her legs is terrible deforming arthritis. She has cancer that is spreading all through her belly, and she has terrible, uncontrollable pain. Does that change things?
No.
Well, no, she's still...
I mean, as far as pulling out the pacemaker?
She's still asking you to.
No, I'm just speaking, you make quality of life the issue. I mean, I'm not challenging you, I'm just trying to put it into an ethical framework as to what's the right thing to do.
Give her a 3-year battery.
Yeah, you're
a
short.
You need to choose the length of time your battery
takes.
Give her a new battery.
Yeah, give her a new battery.
So, yeah, go
Clint, that did happen to my dad, and I'll explain it to you. My dad was 91 years old. He had chronic heart trouble for years and years, erosion, you know, hardening of the arteries. Had a heart attack. My mother and the dad went to the emergency hospital at the University of Washington. The surgeon there put a heart pacemaker in my dad's heart. They called the family to meet. 2 hours later, and the resident had read on his life. And they said that my dad put that decision upon him. Upon regular doctor to put the face of my mother. I said, Mom, what do you think? You live with the man. You think Dad ready to die or not? Well, I don't know. And I don't know if I ever.
You made what seemed like the right decision at the time, and I think that was the right decision. His future was not going to be a very good one if he had lived, and if that artificial means of keeping him alive he was going to be facing a different death, most likely a more difficult one, probably not the very distant future. So.
Is it ethical for a doctor to
That's what I was going to ask.
Without the permission of the family to just go ahead and do that?
Most likely that was a temporary pacemaker. They had not done the permanent one yet.
Oh, okay.
I think almost certainly that was the case. Because we don't, once you put in a permanent pacemaker, I mean, we almost never, I mean, that's why this is sort of an interesting discussion, is that it just is not an accepted practice, medical practice to go in and remove a pacemaker in someone. Not ethically, I think you could justify it for the thing, saying this is artificially keeping someone alive, and they don't want that kind of treatment. Let's go in and remove it. But it's just like active euthanasia and passive euthanasia are two very different things. The same thing of removing a pacemaker but a temporary pacemaker is put in, and then is the discussion with the family. Do we we're temporarily keeping them alive, because you always err on the side. If you decide not to keep somebody alive and they die, we can't even have this discussion about what the quality of life is and what's important or whatever. So sometimes you have to act quickly. And the basic rule is you always, if you don't know, you act on the side of preserving life. Morally or ethically, really no different to remove something you've done than it is not to put it in the first place. We have an emotional response to it that's very, very different. But from an ethical standard, at least in my opinion, it makes no difference. Just because we've started something. John?
The point I wanted to make, in the first example of this woman that before she got cancer and diabetes and all those other things, when she was coming, there's a matter of personal responsibility that she could exercise. She didn't have to come to see you. After you'd explained the situation that she had, she certainly sounded like she was bright enough to make an informed decision at that point. And she could relieve you of the responsibility, the doctor, the responsibility, simply by not coming back for that other check that the battery has. And I think we need to think about what responsibilities we take on ourselves and not leaving it to an ethics board or our doctor to make, our family, to make that hard decision for us.
Excellent point.
Yeah, that's
excellent.
Right.
We're ready to vote.
For you.
That's,
what did she say?
She'd want she'll haunt them.
She'll come back and haunt them.
No, if they resuscitate, if they try to resuscitate.
If they did not honor her wishes.
Yeah, she'd come back and haunt them. And if they don't follow her wishes, or you'll be haunted.
Don't we have laws that may even vary from state to state about these things in place?
Well, we do.
How much you can follow the patient's wishes?
We have homicide laws about killing people, and if you remove that pacemaker, are you actively killing someone? Because, boy, it sure looks like your act led to the death of that patient. And if I were a hotshot young district attorney who wanted to make a name for myself, boy, I'd love to see Dr. Hall, fry on the electric chair or something for having killed this lady. That would be ironic justice to be electrocuted for having removed this electric. they're outlawed, and which we're in uncharted territory, really, because I know of nobody that's done that, and I know of no obvious case has been prosecuted. So, but if somebody, now we have that pacemaker, it's good for 5 more years, lady wants to die, she says, take it out, do a minor surgical procedure and remove it, because right now I'm being treated, and I don't want to be treated. What do you say? Take it out or not? Who wants to take it out?
Can you turn it off instead of taking it out?
You can slow it down. You probably can't turn it off completely. They have sort of a fail-safe thing. You can probably get it down to 25, 30 beats per minute or something. Then that's quality of life issue.
So a non-scrupulous person in the office couldn't sit it down.
Nikki,
can a person request in writing for you? I mean, that woman who came with you and did this in a room, can she put it in writing, do not... replace it.
Oh, if we decided not to replace it, I would have made her write it. Her lawyer would have to sign it. My lawyer would sign it. We would have it. We would have had a real legal document for that. Absolutely. Otherwise, it's fine for her. And it wasn't her. If she died, her daughter, who was also my patient, and we thought we had this wonderful relationship, and maybe we did. But when some lawyer waves big dollar signs in front of the daughter and says, you know what that doctor did to your mother, and you're entitled to something for that. You've lost the companionship of your wonderful, wonderful mother, who said, I have no reason to live. But, you have to protect yourself in this world.
So then once they've signed it, it's their right to deny
it. It is, but they can still sue you. They can still sue you, but you're certainly much better off if you have all these signed documents. We're getting it. Ireland, do you have anything else that you wanted to add to...
No.
Coming back and haunting people if they don't follow. all those who would do a surgical procedure and remove it, or recommend that be done if you were on an ethics board?
Which pacemaker are you talking about?
The one that's absolutely pacemaker dependent. She has she's 90 years old. She has a pacemaker still has a lot of life left in it. And the quality of her life, for whatever reason, she could have terrible associated medical problems, spiritual problems, whatever it is, she just feels that her time has come. She's lived 90 years. She just wants to die. We're artificially keeping her alive by something we did 2 years ago. It's having a long-term effect.
And
those who would say, let's remove it.
And you can go through the process of getting the thing signed so that the doctor himself is protected.
We can, or it doesn't even have to be a doctor, it doesn't have to remove it.
Okay,
anybody that can handle a knife and a pair of pliers. Or you fishermen out there, when you've gutted fish, you could easily...
We're not asking the question, would I be willing to put my doctor in this situation?
No, I'm just saying, is it the right? What do you think? Is it the right thing to do?
Yeah, it is.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
Is it the right thing to do? And then we can talk about the logistics and the mechanics of actually getting it accomplished. But can we say that that's a legitimate request based on autonomy and based on the things of doing good, which for her is a good death, not doing harm, which is prolonging her. There's two ways. They'll get two things on that one. One is doing, from her point of view, keeping her alive longer is doing harm, because she doesn't want to be alive longer. On the other hand, allowing her to die or killing her by the process of taking this out is doing harm. So we have competing interests there. And justice, who's going to pay for this? And because clearly Medicare is not going to pay for this. There's no such code as removing permanent pacemaker to allow patients to die. I submit that to Medicare, they're going to send it back and say, what? You know, so it's not going to be paid for by Medicare. Now, she wants to slip some money to someone to take it out, or somebody's just going to do it. Anyway, I just, without belaboring this case in any further detail, it kind of shows you how a real-life case can introduce a whole series of ethical dilemmas and questions, and how some of these very basic principles can help us maybe make some of the decisions as we go through those.
I had mentioned removing life support. I would like to go back to that if it's timely. If it's a bad time.
Why don't we hold off till tomorrow?
Okay.
Concentrate. We really get into. I wanted to say a few things about cloning. Why don't we hold off for cloning for next time? Let's go. Let's talk about life support while we're talking about it.
Okay. One question about how many doctors would remove the pacemaker?
I'm sorry.
How many doctors would go ahead and remove the pacemaker under all of our other caveats, you know, the legal papers and everything?
Well, it's hard to tell.
That's what I thought.
It'd be very hard. You know, I don't know. I really can't answer that question. It would be with great... So you say, that's not what's killing them.
Yeah.
It's their heart disease.
Right.
You're just no longer keeping them alive.
The one other point, Cliff, is if you walk around to the cemetery right now, how many pacemakers are still going down there? There's some pacemakers in those patients buried in the ground that are still going.
Do they last for a really long time?
I'm serious. I'm not making
that. No, that's if you're buried with a pacemaker, that's the truth. The pacemaker, but it's not doing it. It just fired away.
The pacemaker is firing
away. Unless you.
I mean, that's a weird thing to think about, but they're never doing that.
But they'll all go dead.
Eventually.
You won't go back and go replace the battery.
Good point.
What's really the function of one? I don't even really know what a pacemaker is, except
your heart needs an electrical pacemaker. You have your own pacemaker, your own series of cells that tell the heart how fast to go. And that sends an electrical signal to the heart and it beats. If for some reason those group of cells have been damaged or destroyed or injured so that they no longer firing off on a regular basis, then the heart has its own intrinsic rate, which is very slow, or sometimes it doesn't have any rate at all and the heart just sort of sits there. Well, that doesn't do any good. So you run a wire into it, a little wire fires off a little charge of electricity, and that makes the heart beat. And so,
but it doesn't really pump the heart. It just sends the message to the muscles to do it.
Yeah, that's right. It sends the message to the heart. In the same way, if you've ever touched a hot wire or an electric wire and your arm jerks,
yes.
Muscle jerks, just think of just putting a little bit of an electric charge there, and it just makes the muscle contract. This just makes the heart muscle
contract. And how long do they normally last? Does it vary like crazy?
The pacemaker?
Uh-huh.
The batteries last anywhere from... 5 to 7, 9 years in that range. So then they have to be replaced periodically if you haven't died of something else during that period of time. Gay's point was that a lot of people die of other things and the pacemaker is still firing away, but that a pacemaker will not keep you alive after you have died.
And this thing has to be inserted inside the person?
Yeah.
The wire goes inside and the pacemaker is implanted just under the skin.
How big is it?
Cigarette package.
About the size of take about four $1/2 and line them up and put a little pack. Very small, but it's very tech and mostly battery, and it's got a little computer hooked to it, but a little radio transmitter.
They have no recyclable value.
Yeah, you know, it's a very important point. In some countries, they are recycled. In the United States, it's against the law to recycle. Even if you just put it in yesterday, brand new $6,000 pacemaker, put it in yesterday, patient dies. Today, of some unrelated thing, we have this brand new pacemaker. It cannot
be reused. In Holden Village, they would recycle.
But it could be sterilized and reused. And sometimes, if they are taken out because something was, some reason had to be taken out at the time of surgery or something, we frequently will give those to the vet school in Corvallis, and then because the same pacemakers can be used for animals who need pacemakers.
We can give another country.
They could theoretically be sent to another country. I think it's against U.S. law. Right. You can check this telephonically, and most checking is done that way. But it can be checked in the office as well. But you can put a little device over your pacemaker.
Put a bracelet wrist,
and then that hooks to the telephone, and you dial a number.
Well, I could go back about getting, and they talk.